At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back and thank you all for tuning in this week. For those of you who ask us to cover more disappearances, I have one for you today and a rather puzzling one at that. I don't think I've ever talked about this on the podcast. I know you and I have, but I like listening to long-form true crime podcasts that focus on one unsolved case for a season. And it's kind of a dream of mine to one day have my own. But when I research cases, I sometimes think, oh, this would be a great candidate for a long-form podcast. I felt that way with this case. I think it could greatly benefit from something like that, a reinvestigation, revitalization, just a deep dive into the case. Anyway, that was just a thought I kept having throughout this case that I wanted to share. All right, let's dive in. Barbara Holick was 33 years old at the time of her disappearance in 1995. Not to be confused with Barbara Bullock, the case we covered in our second episode. Born in a small town in Germany, Barbara knew fairly early on in life that she wanted to see as much of the world as possible. As an adult, she found herself working as a travel management assistant and began traveling herself. One of her travel destinations in the United States was Taos, New Mexico. Taos is a picturesque town in the high desert of northern New Mexico. With a rich artistic legacy, the town has long attracted creatives, offering a variety of galleries and museums. And it has quite a few, especially considering it's a town of around 6,000 people now, so not a very big town. Just north of Taos is Taos Pueblo, a sovereign indigenous community whose multi-storied adobe buildings have been continuously inhabited for centuries. When Barbara visited the region as an artist herself, she was deeply moved by its artistic spirit and developed a profound respect and interest in the traditions and heritage of the Pueblo people. It was an easy decision for Barbara to move to New Mexico in 1990 when she was 28. After a short stay in a suburb north of Taos, Barbara established a life for herself in Taos and worked at a local gallery and shop run by Sunny Spruce, a talented jewel maker and artist. Though she wasn't paid a traditional wage, she was allowed to sell her handmade pieces there, including hand-painted pottery and silver jewelry in exchange for her work. So it was a modest but meaningful livelihood. This informal arrangement was partly due to Barbara's undocumented immigration status. While she hoped to apply for citizenship, she was living quietly under the radar up until her disappearance. Barbara lived in a duplex on a dead-end street called Rosarita Lane and lived a quiet, low-key life. Despite this, she maintained a tight social circle with friends she'd made over the years, primarily in the art community, and Barbara was known for being full of fun. So it's no surprise that a couple of days after returning home from a trip to Colorado on Friday, June 23rd, 1995, Barbara made plans to meet up with friends at a local restaurant after work. The restaurant was called El Patio at the time, but it has since been replaced with the Alley Cantina. Barbara lived just a few blocks from the restaurant, so she made the 5 or so minute walk there that evening. Barbara was a regular at this restaurant, and the bartenders later shared that she would usually have a few drinks, typically scotch, but sometimes beer, and she never got out of hand or really even visibly intoxicated. And this night was no different. Barbara enjoyed a few drinks with her friends, who reported she seemed like herself that night. Nothing seemed off. When Barbara left, she didn't mention any other plans she had that night, so it's sort of presumed that she didn't have any and planned to head straight home.
So what time did she end up leaving the bar?
She left the restaurant between 10 and 11 p.m.
So was that a typical departure time for her, since you said she was a regular at that bar slash restaurant?
Yeah, it sounded like this was around the time she would typically wrap up her night. No one reported seeing Barbara for the rest of the weekend. In fact, no one would ever report seeing Barbara again after she stepped foot out of that restaurant. Barbara was scheduled to work the following Monday, June 26th, and when she didn't show up, the gallery and shop owner, Sonny, was surprised. Barbara was dependable, precise, and well-organized. She never missed work, so he paid a visit to her home to check on her. When Sonny arrived at Barbara's duplex, she didn't answer the door, which was a little perplexing because her car, a Ford Fiesta, was parked in the driveway. So he tried opening the door and found that it was unlocked. At that point, he decided to step inside and call out Barbara's name.
Did Barbara and her boss have the type of relationship where just walking into her home would be fine?
I think under this circumstance, yes. They had known each other for several years. She had worked for him for several years, and he knew how dependable she was. So for her to not show up to work, he also knows she lives alone and she's single. So he might be one of the first people to realize that something was wrong, if something's wrong, right? So he got there, he called out for Barbara and received no response. He didn't find Barbara inside. It sounded like he poked around a little bit and observed her purse lying on a living room table, which made matters more confusing. Her car was there, her purse was there, so where was Barbara? Sonny left her home as it was and held off on taking any action that day. However, he returned to her home the next day, Tuesday, around 4 p.m., because Barbara hadn't shown up for work that day either. Sonny found her home exactly as he had seen it the day before, including the unlocked front door. Thinking something was wrong with this situation, Sonny reported Barbara as a missing person to the Taos police. And this kind of goes back to what I was saying about Barbara living alone and how Sonny might be the first person to know something is wrong. And he was. He's the one who reported her missing. So it's not like her friends were checking in with her every single day to know that she hadn't been heard from. One of the first steps they took was searching Barbara's home. They saw her handbag on the living room table, as Sonny described, and inside the bag, they found her ID. Inside her bedroom, her bed was unmade, which could or could not assist in the timeline. I don't know if Barbara was the type to make her bed. I don't know if her friends would have even known that, but she was described as tidy and organized, so it's possible she did make her bed routinely. If so, that would mean she made it back home after leaving the restaurant and got into bed at some point that night, and then got up and didn't make her bed. They found sleepwear sitting out, which also pointed to the possibility that Barbara had made it home that night, woke up the next day and changed, and something happened from there. But how would we know with certainty that those were the clothes she slept in Friday night, if she slept? We don't. They could have been there from the night before. And I would even wonder, Like, if she was the type to make her bed, why would she get up and get dressed and then leave the bed unmade? There was a black bag on her nightstand with rolls of dollar bills in it. Then, in the bathroom, it was reported that the outfit she had been wearing the night she disappeared was hanging up. And I've thought about this detail because I thought it was a little odd. I don't know why her clothes were hung up in the bathroom. It could be that she didn't think they were dirty and just hung them up in there temporarily, or maybe they were wrinkled and she took a hot shower to remove the wrinkles.
That's an interesting detail, but do you think it has anything to do with the case?
No, probably not. I can't think of how this would be connected to the case unless it's related to the timeline, as in, oh, she always hung up her clothes after a shower and then she'd put them away the next morning. You know what I mean? Like, oh, she wasn't able to do that the next morning. But no, otherwise, I think it's just kind of an interesting detail that probably has nothing to do with anything.
So we know the front door was unlocked. So there doesn't seem to be any signs of a break-in or forced entry. Were there any signs of a struggle within the home?
Not inside her home. Overall, it was in an orderly condition with one exception. A pair of work gloves were on the floor. One was near an exterior door and the other was in front of her refrigerator. No one knows why these gloves were on the floor in the first place, and it couldn't be confirmed that they belonged to Barbara. And that might not seem strange if the rest of her house weren't so orderly, but because it was, the gloves stood out. Plus, why were they in different parts of her home? This was the only sign they found in her home that something was off, but it could be something that if Barbara were here now, she could easily explain. Even if someone entered Barbara's home and harmed her, I'm not sure how the gloves would be involved because she probably wouldn't have been wearing the gloves that night. I did think of one theory here, though. I was thinking maybe the gloves were in the kitchen on the counter. Someone attacked her in the kitchen. The gloves were knocked off the counter. She was then incapacitated. Then they dragged her from the kitchen to the exterior door, and that second glove was caught under her body during that. I mean, it seems like a long way for a glove to travel, but I think this is a possibility, although it is simply a theory and these gloves could be a red herring.
I wish we knew more about these gloves. Just based on the size of them, we'd be able to know whether they were hers or someone else's.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I was going to mention this at the end, but I'm thinking about requesting records in this case. I almost never do that with the cases we cover because they can typically deny records requests based on it being an active and ongoing investigation, right? Which makes sense, but I don't think this case is very active at all. So I'm hoping maybe I can get some more information here. You know, it could be a long shot, but that's what I'm thinking right now. So who knows? We might get more information on these gloves or potential other evidence in this case. Now, remember that this was a duplex, which is why I emphasize that they didn't find much in her home. There was more going on in the other unit. Early reports about Barbara's disappearance indicated that she had access to the adjoining unit so she could turn exterior lights on and off. I question this because it seems like a safety violation for anyone living in the other unit, which had tenants from time to time, to allow the other tenant to have a key to both units. Now, not to suggest Barbara was up to no good by any means, it just generally seems unusual. Although, if that was the only way to access the light switches for the exterior lights, then it seems unfair for her not to have access. But the police chief at the time confirmed that she did have access for that purpose. The Taos News reported in 2015 that four men had been living on the other side of the duplex temporarily until the very day of Barbara's disappearance. However, it's unclear how long they had been staying there, but it was described as a short-term rental. The four men were in Taos for business, but it's also unclear what sort of industry they worked in. They vacated the unit the morning of Friday, June 23rd. And recall, Barbara was last seen the night of June 23rd. A housekeeper visited the home Friday during the day to clean and didn't notice anything unusual after the men had vacated the residence. The housekeeper returned the next day, Saturday, June 24th, and the home was not exactly how she'd left it. Bear in mind that no one should have been in there between Friday and Saturday except potentially Barbara, who might have turned the exterior lights on or off if she truly had access. But I would even question that because how would she know that no one was over there? Do you know what I mean? Like, unless the owner was telling her exactly when people would be renting out the other side of the duplex, she wouldn't know. So it seems a little odd that she would be going over there if she knew that people had been in there that morning or the day before. Something else to note is that this unit was furnished, or at least partially furnished, for tenants because by the time the men left, there was still furniture in the home. The housekeeper found a pair of black sandals on the couch, later confirmed as belonging to Barbara. The mattress in the bedroom, which had been fully made the day before, was now stripped of its mattress cover, sheet, and blanket. And those items have never been recovered. A chair that was previously under the kitchen table had been moved to another spot in the room, and the cord between the base of the telephone in the unit and the receiver had been cut. So Barbara's home didn't seem to indicate that a crime had occurred. And while there was no biological evidence in the adjoining unit, these were certainly signs that a crime may have occurred there. And the time that has passed has only made that more likely because no one has admitted to being in that home the night of June 23rd. But clearly, someone was. When the housekeeper came upon this situation on Saturday to finish cleaning because it sounded like she started the cleaning process on Friday and was there to finish it on Saturday, she didn't think too much of it. She knew nothing of Barbara's disappearance, and she continued cleaning, potentially removing any biological evidence.
I'm sure you're going to mention this, but were these guys found and questioned?
Yes, but not until a month after Barbara was reported missing. The police interviewed the men at their company's office in Albuquerque, a couple of hours from Taos. For reasons that remain unknown, the investigators refrained from asking the men where they were the night of Barbara's disappearance. A key question I think we'd all like to know the answer to, because apparently they had vacated the unit the morning of Barbara's disappearance, but someone was in there and we don't know who. When asked if they knew Barbara, each of the men said they didn't. Some even claimed they hadn't seen her at all during their stay in the duplex. That isn't too surprising. If they were only there for a short period, it's possible they didn't cross paths. And Barbara had lived in that duplex for years, but her neighbors on Rosarita Lane said they didn't know her. They also didn't see anything of importance related to Barbara's disappearance. They questioned the men about the bars and restaurants they visited while they were in Taos, likely in an attempt to connect them to the places Barbara frequented. But it appears this was a fairly short interview with little valuable information gleaned. And it drives me nuts that we don't know if they had an alibi, because if we believe that the scene and the adjoining space is related to Barbara's disappearance, there is a short window in which something happened to her. It had to be between, you know, after she left the restaurant around 10 or 11 p.m. Friday night, but before the housekeeper returned Saturday. If they could account for their time, if they could prove they were in Albuquerque or somewhere else that whole time, that would be huge. Although proving your alibi overnight is kind of difficult. The police initially questioned if Barbara may have up and left her life. When investigators searched her home, they discovered that her passport was missing. However, several signs suggested she hadn't left willingly. Her ID, luggage, and thousands of dollars in cash were still in the house. And it's neither here nor there, but there was a lottery ticket in her home from her recent Colorado trip. So if she wanted to take off, she could have at least taken that. Investigators found a voicemail on Barbara's answering machine that came through 2 days after she vanished from a German friend who was planning a visit to the U.S. She had arranged to lend him camping gear and bought tickets for a rafting tour in anticipation of a stay in Taos. Already in the country when she went missing, he traveled to Taos immediately and helped investigators by translating for Barbara's family. Additionally, they found no record of Barbara leaving the United States. The police were able to access phone records quickly since she was renting the duplex. The phone was linked to the out-of-state owner's name, and the owner gave the police the go-ahead on accessing those records. Nothing stood out. There were no long-distance calls, no repeated calls to one number, nothing to support the idea that she was planning to leave. The missing passport was cleared up in August, though, 2 months after Barbara's disappearance, when Barbara's brother, a German police officer, visited Taos and cleared out her home. As he sorted through Barbara's belongings, he found her passport amongst them. So the police missed that in their search of Barbara's home. To add to all of this, Barbara's friends and family did not believe she would leave like this without telling anyone. All of this compiles to show that the probability that Barbara left her life is extremely low, especially when coupled with the circumstances on the other side of the duplex. As the police looked into Barbara's background, they learned that she had once been married. Barbara married a man with a checkered past named Thomas in August 1991, so 4 years before she disappeared. Thomas once worked as a bartender at El Patio, the same restaurant Barbara went to the night of her disappearance, and it's presumed that's where they met. Allegedly, Thomas and Barbara's marriage was less about romance and more about ensuring she could stay in the U.S. Although I haven't seen it reported definitively, it's possible that they did not have an intimate relationship at all. Some sources contend that the marriage lasted only 6 weeks, ending when Barbara discovered he was already married. But public records indicate Barbara filed for divorce 2 years after they married, long after Thomas had been in Taos, and it was finalized in February 1994. Now, I said that Thomas had a checkered past because he was a known cocaine dealer and user. He was arrested and charged with theft and possession of stolen property in Carson City, Nevada, around the time of Barbara's disappearance. In 2003, he was arrested again on forgery charges. He had committed various other crimes, and the police were interested in him as a potential suspect. But he was ruled out once they learned that he was in jail when Barbara disappeared. So he had a pretty solid alibi.
So what's the investigator's theory at this point? Are they going down one specific avenue? It kind of seems like they're scrambling and haven't done the best job, especially questioning the men and not even asking where they were that night.
Yeah, so pretty early on, they started to say that they suspected foul play. Of course, they put it out there that they were wanting to find her passport, you know, confirm she hadn't left the country and started a new life. But yeah, they started to go down the path of foul play, although, like we'll talk about later, over the years, the opinions have varied and not everyone on the Taos police force believes that Barbara was a victim of foul play, but it was starting to go that direction. Another interesting character popped up on their radar when they found a library card belonging to a known criminal in Barbara's possession. The card belonged to Olaf Peter Judah, a convicted drug smuggler who had previously lived either next door to Barbara or with Barbara when she first moved to the U.S. and socialized with people she knew. Along with the library card, they found keys to a Taos storage unit that belonged to Olaf inside Barbara's home. In 1991, Olaf was arrested when he and several others sank a boat carrying drugs off the West Coast to hide evidence. Authorities later seized nearly $90,000 and other assets from him in New Mexico, and the very storage unit Barbara had keys to was searched at that time. Though he became a person of interest in Barbara's disappearance, he was serving a 22-year federal prison sentence by 1995 when Barbara disappeared. In 1996, he sued the Taos police chief for defamation, denying involvement in Barbara's case and stating that he hadn't seen her in years. I couldn't find follow-up on this lawsuit. I wouldn't be surprised if it were dismissed because the statements I read from the police chief didn't seem defamatory, but it's possible that he made statements we aren't aware of in papers that haven't been archived in a way that we can access them. Either way, it doesn't appear Olaf is connected to Barbara's disappearance. And he was involved, obviously, in illegal activities, and so was her ex-husband. But I want to be clear that there's zero information out there to support that Barbara was involved in anything they were caught up in.
So you said they could have been living in the same complex or living together. Was that based on a source said?
Yeah, different sources in this case. You know, one source said they were living together. I don't know why. Another source said they just lived in the same building. So it could be that they were just neighbors, but they did know each other. That's for sure. But again, he was in prison when Barbara disappeared. So there's really no evidence support that he was directly involved in her disappearance. And he apparently hadn't seen her for a long time leading up to her disappearance anyway. So there's no reason to believe that he was connected to this. It was just kind of an odd link they made to find a convicted drug smuggler's library card in her belongings. The police received numerous tips and tracked down many different leads over the years. I'd say in this case, there were more leads I read about with no follow-up than any other case, so I want to walk through some of them. In December 1995, about 6 months after Barbara vanished, a man was arrested in Tucson, Arizona, for the murder of a 14-year-old girl whose body was found near a campsite he had once stayed. Initially considered a runaway, she had been sexually assaulted, her clothing cut off, and killed by blunt force and asphyxiation. The suspect was believed to have been in the Taos area when Barbara disappeared. That July, he had spent time at a Rainbow Family of Living Light gathering near Taos. Though often viewed as unconventional, the Rainbow Family is generally considered a free-spirited, anti-establishment community. And if it sounds like I'm talking about a cult, I'm not. You might say it's cult adjacent, but the Rainbow Family is not a cult. A group of Rainbow members had been renting a home across the street from Barbara at the time of her disappearance. Some reports indicate the suspect may have been staying there as well. This lead is far more interesting if the suspect was in fact in a house across the street from Barbara the night of her disappearance. Anytime you have a violent criminal in the direct vicinity like this, it has to be looked into. To my knowledge, the police found no evidence to connect this man to Barbara's case.
Yeah, I suppose one key difference, though, is this guy left his victim out in the open near the campsite as opposed to Barbara, whose body hasn't even been found.
Yeah, that's a good point. It would be quite a big difference. If he did harm Barbara, he left no sign of it. So yeah, I think he took very few steps, it seemed like, to cover his tracks with his victim. So yeah, that would be a big difference. And I kind of wondered if, you know, maybe there's a theory here with the people in the house across the street. I was thinking, okay, maybe as Barbara walked home from the restaurant, they were outside, they invited her in for a drink or something. But it appears she made it back in her home, most likely, and changed. And then you have the whole situation in the duplex next door. Like, what was going on there? So I don't think that's a very viable theory in this case. Also in December 1995, the police searched an area near Millicent Rogers Museum, north of Taos, after they received a tip from a juvenile who claimed he saw a body there 6 months earlier, right around the time Barbara disappeared. He neglected to come forward for so long because he didn't want to be involved. The police did not find a body during their search, but they found a film camera. They developed the film, but did not report if they found anything of interest in the photos. And there were a lot of other various leads like this, where people reported seeing a body or seeing remains. And every time the police looked into it, either they couldn't find a body or they found bones and they were not human. So all of these potential leads just turned into dead ends. Then in 2003, a lead was investigated that should have been looked into in 1995. A man reported that he was hiking with friends in a high mesa wilderness area outside of Taos approximately a month after Barbara was reported missing. A blood-soaked, expensive-looking blouse hanging from a tree caught their eye. Shortly thereafter, this man ran into a friend of Barbara's, and he had heard about Barbara's disappearance through the news. So when the witness talked with Barbara's friend and brought up this blouse, the friend suggested that the blouse's description sounded similar to one Barbara owned. After learning this, the man decided to report his finding to the police multiple times and failed to receive a call back time and time again. So no one from the police actually spoke to him about this. The man contacted the police again 8 years later in 2003 when he read about Barbara's disappearance in the local papers. He finally reached someone and subsequently the police went out to the specified location and found the blouse still hanging from the tree, which is quite remarkable considering this was 8 years later. The shirt was in poor condition, torn, sun bleached, and badly deteriorated. Still, the investigators planned to send it to the state crime lab in Santa Fe for analysis. If anything of value was recovered from this blouse, it has also not been reported on. Barbara's brother has spoken about the agonizing uncertainty that comes with their loved one disappearing, as well as the fact that their parents never seemed to recover. When their father died in 2007, they knew she would have contacted them if she were somehow still alive. I think it's unlikely this case will be solved with physical evidence unless her remains have already been found and she hasn't been linked to them yet. And not that that would solve the case, but the location and circumstances could be telling. It seems more likely that this case will be solved through someone with information coming forward and sharing what they know, or the police looking back through all the files and making a connection they hadn't previously made. There's no one we're aware of who would have wanted to harm Barbara. So the most promising lead we know of would probably be the four men who were staying in the other half of the duplex Barbara lived in. But the odds of them all conspiring to harm Barbara and then keeping that a secret for years and years are fairly low. If any of them were involved, it's possible not all of them were. Maybe they drove separately and one of them stayed behind in Taos, or maybe they all went back to Albuquerque and then one returned, right? The opinions of the Taos Police Department have changed over the years. Like I said, some believe that she left and started a new life. I mean, she was used to living under the radar, so it wouldn't be impossible, but others believe she was a victim of foul play. One police officer strangely said in 2015 that he believed she just wanted to return to Germany, despite the complete lack of evidence that she did this. I certainly believe Barbara was a victim of foul play, possibly in a crime of opportunity, but there could be much more to the story here. Everything about the adjoining unit of Barbara's duplex is off. Why did the housekeeper see her shoes in there suddenly when they weren't there the day prior? Why was the telephone cord or wire cut and the bedding removed? The former police chief has said himself that it wasn't the strongest investigation. So we don't know how much of a factor that played here. It definitely played a role. Would her case still be unsolved if the investigation had been more thorough? Possibly, but also possibly not.
I still think the four men are definitely suspicious. At the same time, while you were talking, I was thinking about how someone could have seen these guys packing up. They were leaving, moving out. They could have seen that as an opportunity to use this empty duplex as a place of opportunity to commit this crime on Barbara. And I know when I've moved out of places, I've typically been told to leave the door unlocked and leave the keys inside for the owner or the property manager to come pick up after you've left. So the duplex could have been just an unlocked, empty space for this crime to have occurred. And the four men could have had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm. And that would be a good question for the housekeeper or the owner. I think the owner has passed away. I believe I found her obituary online. But the person who went to the house that day, the housekeeper, like, was it unlocked? Was that common practice for them? Could someone have just walked in there without any trouble? We don't know. Or if the four men had one key, or did they have two keys? Did they leave them behind, or were the keys missing? Like, these are all questions I want the answer to. But I guess I'm wondering for you, like, do you have any ideas of how, if someone, in your theory, if someone was doing that, how they lured her from her home to the other side of the duplex? Or do you think they went into her home and then forced her over there? Or what are you thinking along those lines?
Yeah, it could be either. They could have asked for help or something. Or in the case of the four men, there wouldn't be any real struggle, right? I mean, they could just pretty easily overpower her since there's four of them versus one of her.
If they were all involved.
If they were all involved, yeah. Even if there were three involved or two.
Yeah, and I kept thinking as I was researching this case, like, maybe Barbara stepped over there for some reason and then she walked in on something. There were people in there and then the crime occurred for some reason. I mean, the bedding being gone is really concerning to me. It's possible they, or, you know, whoever it was, carried her out of there in that, transported her body wrapped in the mattress cover and the sheet and the blanket and all of that. But I don't really know why she would be over there unless it was to switch the lights. But then you think about the timing of it. The timing doesn't really make sense either. If she did get in bed that night, that's what's throwing me off. If she just came home and they could tell she made it home and then it seemed like something happened, it would make a little more sense to me that maybe she walked over there. But the fact that it looks like she got into bed that night, that throws me off a little bit. So, like, did she get up in the middle of the night? Did she hear something and go over there? We don't know. This case is so puzzling.
It does seem like she walked over there since her shoes were found in the other duplex, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, why else would they be over there? And then if someone did harm her in there and then removed her body, they could have left the shoes behind as an oversight, maybe. But I mean, also the fact that they were on the couch is a little weird. And then the chair that was should have been under the dining room table being like in a different part of the home makes no sense. If anybody has a solid theory on what they think happened, please share with us. You can do that on Instagram at Key to the Case Podcast, or via email at keyofthecase@gmail.com. At the time of Barbara's disappearance, she was 5 feet tall and weighed around 120 pounds. She is a white female with brown hair and brown eyes. She spoke with a German accent. Her ears were pierced and she would be 63 years old today. If you have information related to the disappearance of Barbara Holick, please contact the Taos Police at 575-758-4656. Thank you all so much for tuning in this week. I hope this won't be the last time we talk about Barbara's case. Like I said before, I want to submit a request for records in this case. Typically don't do that, but who knows? Could be worth a shot here since it is an older case. And I'm really not sure that it's considered open and active like many of the other cases we cover. And we forgot to tell you guys that this is the first case we've recorded as a married couple. We got married last week. The episode we recorded We actually like pre-recorded that so we wouldn't have to record around the time of our wedding. But yeah, it was a beautiful day.
It's crazy to think that when we started this podcast, we were just dating and then we got engaged and now we're married.
Yeah. And hopefully we can continue to do the podcast through all of our next big life events. Thank you all so much again for listening. That is all for now, but we will be back in 2 weeks with a new case. Bye.
Bye.
Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please.
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you are sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.